Good morning, and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. We're working on getting hooked up with our first guest, and we have our fingers crossed. We think everything is going to go well here. We're talking in the first hour of Focus 580 with Philip Ball. He's a consulting editor for Nature magazine. He is a regular commentator on science in Great Britain, and we're speaking to him from there, so that's where the little bit of complication comes in. His book, Bright Earth, was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. He won Great Britain's prestigious Aventis Prize for Science Books for his book Critical Mass. He makes his home in London. And we will be talking here in this first hour of the show about a recent book that he has published. The title of the book is Universe of Stone. The subtitle is A Biography of Chartres Cathedral, and the book is published by Harper. This is a building that I think a lot of people would agree is probably one of the most stunning and beautiful buildings in all of Europe. And when that building was constructed, this was in the 12th and 13th centuries, it took church building in a new direction, a style that now we call Gothic. But one of the questions that Philip Ball tries to answer in his book is, we can talk about what this building means to us now, but what did it mean to the people who built it? He makes the argument in his book that Gothic cathedrals were the products of a new way, actually a new way of looking at the world, seeing it as a place that was orderly and rational, a place that could be investigated and understood. He's joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk with Philip Ball, of course, questions from people who are listening are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and we do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, certainly questions, comments are welcome. The only thing we ask of people who call in is that they try to keep their questions, comments brief, just so we can keep moving along, but of course, anyone's welcome to call. Again, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Ball, hello.
Hi.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
We appreciate that. I'm sorry we had maybe had a little bit of confusion here at the beginning, but we're all set up and we're in motion.
Great.
I have not been there. I have not had the opportunity to see the building in person. All I know it from is from photographs. Tell me what it's like to stand there, to stand in front of it and to look up at those spires and to actually go inside.
Well, you know, this is a place that apparently Napoleon Bonaparte said that it's a place that would make atheists feel uneasy. And I know what he means, because it's a place that has an extraordinary sense of, first of all, of antiquity, of power, and of something... I guess one would have to say something spiritual, really, whether you're a believer or not, I think. It's very hard to say what creates that effect, but I think it has something to do with, first of all, the light, the extraordinary light that comes through. It's actually in some ways, quite a gloomy church because these windows are so heavily colored. But also, I think something to do with the sheer scale of the structure and the scale of the stones that go into it. It really made my knees tremble to think that these stones had been moved by people in the early Middle Ages with what could be seen as very primitive technologies, but somehow they managed it. Mm-hmm. It also stands in an extraordinary location as you approach Chartres itself, the city. You can see it from a long way away because the cathedral stands on an outcrop of rock on a very sort of flat plain. You see these spires from a long distance away, and when you get there, this outcrop is looking over a river, and it really sort of looms over the whole city. And you can get some sense, I think, of how awesome it would have been to people in the Middle Ages to have had a structure of this magnitude appear within their city and loom over them in that way.
Yeah. I'm sure that we want to talk a little bit about the task of how it came to be, how it was designed, how it was constructed, and so forth. But to ask a more kind of contemporary question, and it's one of the things that I think that I know interests you. If we speak of a building as something that can be read, if you'll allow that kind of metaphor, that kind of image, then what story does the Chartres Cathedral tell?
Well, I think probably most obviously, straight away, it tells a story of power and authority. And it was very clearly a part of a statement that the churchmen were making that time, partly of their sort of spiritual authority and status within society. One has to say also that there was a degree of sort of one-upmanship often in these buildings, that the people who commissioned them would often, you know, want theirs to be the grandest, the most imposing, and that would somehow reflect on their own sort of authority in the region. But I think that there are also many other, that there are a multitude of stories that are literally told within the building, because they're told in the windows. So these stained glass windows tell mostly biblical stories, stories of the saints, and stories of the Passion, stories of the genealogy of Christ. So, you know, there are references to his links to the Old Testament. And all of these were essentially sort of devices. The windows are often called the Bibles of the illiterate. So they were devices for showing the ordinary person who, in all probability, couldn't read and perhaps had never seen a book, for instructing them about the biblical stories.
Hmm. There had been churches before on this site, wooden churches, so nothing like this. And apparently this work was done at a time when there was a lot of church building all over France, large and small. How, though, did it come to be that such a large, stunningly magnificent, important church happened to be built there in Chartres?
Well, Chartres was an important center both spiritually and commercially at that time. It was on a crossing point of trade routes, and it was in a region that was itself sort of noted for its production of particularly of bread. But it also hosted an important market every year, and people would come from the north with woolen textiles, and from other regions as well. So there was an important commercial center here. But it had also, for a long time, been linked with a cult of the Virgin, and that it was a widely recognized center of pilgrimage for people who were coming to pay their respects to the Virgin. So it was, by the time the Gothic cathedral was built, it was actually a relatively prosperous town, and, you know, was sort of widely recognized as a religious center.
Mm. And there's the story that previous to the building of the cathedral, there was a church there, and it was said to house a relic, a cloak, I think it was, that was said to belong to Mary. And it was there, and there was a fire. The church burned down. People thought that, in fact, this important thing had been lost. And lo and behold, up out of the ashes come some priests who had been hiding out, essentially, had found a place to hide to escape the fire. At least that's what the story goes. The story goes, and they came out, and here they had this important relic, and people thought this was a miracle. And that might also explain why it was that, I guess, when the church was built, people actually all over France contributed money to the building of the project. Probably if it was just up to the people of Chartres to reach into their pockets, they might not have been able to do such a thing. But people thought it was important enough so that they gave, people all over gave money.
That's right. Any church in the Middle Ages was very proud of any relics that it might possess. That is religious relics that were said to have come from biblical times. So, you know, churches had things like bones of the saints, or pieces of the cross, of Christ's cross was often a sort of favorite claim. But Chartres in particular had this extremely valuable, extremely precious relic, which was essentially a length of cloth. It's often referred to as a tunic, although it's not exactly a tunic in the sense that we would think of it. But it was essentially said to be a wrapping that the Virgin Mary had worn either at the time of Christ's birth or at the time of the Annunciation. The story varies slightly. And this was a relic that had come from Constantinople. So it was housed within the church, and it was really the sort of most precious possession that the churchmen had, and was contributed towards the cult of the Virgin, and was said to have miraculous powers in the sense that the people of the city of Chartres had come to believe that the whole prosperity and the security of the city somehow depended on this relic. So when it was rumored that the relic had been destroyed by the fire that destroyed the previous church, there was sort of cause for despair, not only because the church had lost its precious item, but also that seemed to threaten the security of the city and also the prosperity, because it had lost one of its, if you like, one of its big draws for pilgrims. Now, cynics might wonder whether there was an element of stage management in the way that this relic seemed to sort of reappear, carried in a procession at just the time that a lot of the citizens were gathered in a square, listening to a cleric who was sort of telling them that really they had to rally round and rebuild their church. But nevertheless, that's the way the story goes. It seems that subsequently there was a fair bit of propagandizing, really, both in terms of this relic and in terms of the sense that it was that this was a holy miracle that had preserved it, because the churchmen realized that this was a way to persuade people that the Virgin Mary was really calling on them to build a new church. So they made a big play of this apparently sort of miraculous preservation of the tunic. That was something that was described in a document that was written in the 13th century to try to drum up funds, to try to drum up donations for the building of the church.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Philip Ball. He's consulting editor for Nature magazine, regular commentator on science in Great Britain. He is the author of a recent book titled Universe of Stone, a biography of Chartres Cathedral, about this extraordinary building and how it came to be. The book is published by Harper, and you can certainly find it in the bookstore or the library. Questions, comments, too, are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. What I mentioned just at the beginning in trying to make a brief introduction, that this church in its style represented an important departure from what had gone before, from the Romanesque style of church building to what then came to be called Gothic. The people at the time didn't call it that. But what exactly would be the important differences between a Gothic cathedral like this and one that was built in the Romanesque style?
Well, in terms of what one immediately sees, I think the first thing that strikes you is that the Gothic buildings seem just more airy, lighter. It almost seems that some of them can hardly be built of stone at all. They seem almost sort of frameworks for holding these incredibly large and colorful stained glass windows that are characteristic of Gothic. Whereas the Romanesque buildings are often much more squat, heavy buildings with smaller windows. So that's really what sort of strikes you. But I think behind that, what one can really say is that the Gothic building expresses a philosophy. It really expresses a worldview, which is something that isn't really apparent in the Romanesque buildings. There are symbolic aspects, certainly, of Romanesque, but there was never particularly an attempt, certainly in the earlier Romanesque, to try to say something with the entire building, to try to somehow bring all the elements of the building together in a unified structure. It was put together in a sort of somewhat ad hoc way, simply to make a building that would stand up. Now that may be going a bit far. You know, there are some very impressive, very beautiful examples of Romanesque. But I think with Gothic, what we really see is a building conceived of as a whole, and one in which very often we find that the smallest elements of the building reflect larger structures. There's a kind of a hierarchy of structure in the building, so that you will see perhaps elements of a one of the large arches that might be used in a flying buttress or in one of the big windows reflected in at a smaller scale elsewhere in the building. So there's a sense that somehow this whole building is woven together as a unified structure.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that when you look at it and when you stand inside, you see these vast volumes, enormously high ceilings. It's one of the things that it appears to be doing is it appears to be defying gravity. One wonders whether there wouldn't have been people at the time who might have said, to build something like this, maybe is this hubris? I mean, to throw up a work like this and to demonstrate that you can do it, demonstrate that you have the capability, I mean, it may be going beyond saying that we have the mechanical and the engineering skills to do it, but it makes a statement about what it is possible for humans to do.
Well, that's true. Although it doesn't seem very easy to find criticisms of that nature in this time. It doesn't seem very often that people were actually saying, this building is somehow a statement of arrogance because it's so big. Whether or not that was because those sorts of statements would have challenged the authority of the people who were building it isn't clear. It's certainly true that that there were concerns expressed about whether one could literally keep a building standing if it was made too tall. And certainly some of the Gothic churches did prove to be unstable. There were some catastrophic collapses for one reason or another. Sometimes not always because the buildings were literally built too high, but for other structural reasons. Some of the criticisms that were raised were more to do with the question of whether buildings like this should look sort of glorious and opulent, or whether they should look simple. To the Cistercians, who were a very powerful religious order during the early Gothic period, they insisted that that churches shouldn't indulge in sort of elaborate ornamentation and decoration. They made this argument for the Romanesque churches as much as the Gothic churches. They wanted simplicity. Whereas others really felt that somehow by making a building beautiful and elaborate and adorning it with costly wall hangings and with jewels and so forth, that all of this was an expression of piety and that it was a kind of an offering to God. So there was a lot of disagreement at the time about how a church should look.
We have some callers here. Let's start out with someone in the community of Belgium, not all that far away from us. This is our line number 4. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you both. I have several questions, and I'll try to phrase them now, and then we can go on. First off, how did they have a continuity of the design? Because these usually took 100 years. So obviously the first man who started the design was not around when the thing was finished. So there must have been some kind of general plan to move through with. Number two, these things are built, obviously, a great deal out of stone. So is the choice of the site dictated by the proximity of the stone to do it, like the Parthenon and the pyramids? And thirdly, the last question is, how do they heat these things? You never see any chimneys or anything. Are they cold all the time? I think that covers most of the questions I have.
All right. Well, those are all excellent questions. Maybe just as a way of starting off to answer that first question, I should have asked earlier perhaps, but I'll ask now, how long did it take to build this?
Well, yes. Chartres is fairly extraordinary in that respect as well, because the caller is quite right that often these buildings took many generations, perhaps 100 years or more. In fact, some of them were never really completed. But Chartres, astonishingly, took only about 30 years from start to finish. It was begun. The Gothic building was begun in 1194 after a big fire. It was actually only consecrated in 1260, but the building was essentially finished by the 1230s, by the 1220s even. So that happened in an amazingly short time. You know, within potentially the lifespan of one person. But that was unusual, and the question of continuity is a very, very good one. And I think really one would have to answer that by saying often there wasn't continuity. That you know, some of these churches are a real mixture of styles from different periods. One of the wonderful things about Chartres is the fact that it does have this unity, that it was completed within a relatively short space of time and then wasn't tampered with subsequently. Whereas for some of the other Gothic cathedrals, we find that they're a mixture of styles, because by the time it had been completed, or part of the building had been completed, there was another bishop who sort of looked at it and thought, well, that looks a bit old-fashioned now. Actually, I want something different for my nave. And so, you know, the nave would be in a different style. So, you know, to some extent, there wasn't even a feeling that continuity was necessarily important. You know, they did feel fairly free to play around and add elements and so forth. But there were also, from at least the early 13th century, it seems that people began to make plans, began to make detailed drawings. So there was at least some sort of record of what the intentions of a master builder were. For Chartres, it's not clear that there were ever plans. There may or may not have been, but for the early Gothic period, it seems that, you know, there wasn't anything like that degree of organization in the way they were made. And so it would have been very hard for someone coming later to a project to deduce what their predecessors had in mind for, you know, a project that probably wasn't completed at that stage. There was also the problem of funding, that sometimes the funding ran out during the building process and might sort of stop building for decades. So again, you know, someone else would then have to pick up without necessarily any clear idea of what had been planned before. So continuity is, you know, it happens to varying degrees. The question of where the stone comes from is a very good one, because it's certainly very true that a local source of stone for any of these buildings was extremely important. Importing and transporting stone was one of the most expensive parts of a project of this sort, and so it really mattered to people that they could find a good local source, a local quarry, so that they didn't have to transport stone over long distances. And we find records of bishops and builders, you know, scouring the local territory for sources of stone. In the case of Chartres, there was one. There was a quarry at a place called Bercher, which is fairly nearby, and that was certainly, you know, one of the things that helped make a project of this magnitude possible and helped it be completed in such a short space of time. So that was certainly important. The question of how they were heated or whether they were heated, I think it seems fairly clear that they were cold places, and there was no getting around that, not only because, you know, they're on such a sort of big scale and, you know, they're made of, if you like, cold stone, but also because for a lot of the time, of course, these buildings weren't completed. They, you know, the bits of roof were missing, bits of wall were missing. So they would have been cold places to worship, and to some degree, that would have been probably ameliorated during the earlier middle ages by the fact that was a period of unusually warm climate. It's called the medieval warm period by climatologists, and one has to regard it as a very fortunate thing for these church building projects that, you know, they were done within that period, because after that came the period of the Little Ice Age, which we can see in pictures of people like Bruegel from the 15th, 16th centuries, where the climate got very, very cold, and one can at least wonder whether church building on this scale would have been possible in a climate of that sort.
Right. Well, I want to thank the caller. Excellent questions all. We're already at our midpoint. We have others I'd like to go on. And just very quickly, let me introduce once again the guest, Philip Ball. He is a consulting editor for Nature magazine, regular commentator on science in Great Britain, author of the book Universe of Stone, a biography of Chartres Cathedral, and it's published by HarperCollins. We have other questions. Up next, someone in Champagne in line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
The speaker just got to this point as I made my call. If we go to Chartres today, all the stonework is absolutely bare and clean and scrubbed clean. I've heard it asserted that many Gothic cathedrals were, in fact, gaudily painted all over their stonework. They would have been decorated with hangings and tapestries and banners, et cetera, et cetera. Do we really know what the interior of Chartres would have been like at the time that it was being used? And does its present state actually reflect that? That's my question.
All right. Well, again, a fine question. Mr. Ball?
Yes, well, that's another very nice question. We do have a pretty good idea of what Chartres looked like at the time, and the caller is absolutely right that it wasn't this bare stone, that it was painted. There are remnants of some of that paint sort of high up in places on the walls so that we can reconstruct something of what it would have looked like. And it seems that at Chartres, the paint scheme was mostly in a kind of ochre yellow with some of the if you like, the skeleton of the building, some of the pillars and the other sort of structural elements of the building picked out in white, almost like a sort of white skeleton. So it's really quite striking and very, very different from what we see now. And also it's certainly true that on top of that, there would have been things like wall hangings and so forth. So inside, to our minds now, a lot of these places would have probably looked actually very gaudy. You know, we've become used to this idea that that medieval buildings, just like the buildings of antiquity, we've become used to the idea that they were made from this bare stone, and we've now sort of adjusted to that aesthetic, and we sort of think there's something very nice and simple and pleasing in that. But that wasn't at all how the people in the Middle Ages saw it. You know, they were very happy to cover their buildings. In fact, they wanted to cover their buildings with bright paint. Other Gothic cathedrals have evidence of, for example, red color schemes, which could have been quite extraordinary to have been inside. So this paintwork has just been lost over time, and there have occasionally been debates about whether, you know, one should try to restore it to give a better sense of what these buildings looked like at the time. I think I think quite rightly the sort of prevailing view now is that that's not the right thing to do, just as it's not the right thing to do to sort of repaint bits of old paintings that have become worn away, that, you know, we have to simply sort of acknowledge the fact that time has changed these structures. But yes, it's absolutely true that you know, in the Middle Ages they would have looked very different from what we see today.
All right, I thank the call. Let's talk with someone in Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Oh, hi. Very interesting. I've been to Chartres numerous times, and I spent a summer once when I was in graduate school doing the pilgrimage route, where, you know, the pilgrims would go around and look at the reliquaries and all that crap. And but I was going to. One of my professors once said that. When you can tell what is important to a society by the largest buildings in the town, and Chartres just stands out it's a beautiful building, and it's very psychologically powerful to look at. And you were correct in saying that nobody read back then because you don't have the press like you have the Gutenberg press. So basically, everybody had to visualize everything, which is why you have these sculptures, relaying the biblical stories, reinforcing the mythology of the church. And I always thought it was interesting that when you go to these churches and you look up the idea of the elevation of the spires and the naves, they get higher and higher as the centuries go by, sort of this sort of uplifting spiritual thing. And it is, even in modern times, maybe you're like, well, I'm not religious at all, but even though I have a PhD in early Christian art, I look at this stuff and I think, if you walked in there, wow, this is great. God's up there in the roof. But so I'm not sure what you think about that.
Well, I certainly like the comment that you started with. As it happens, I'm sitting here on a hill overlooking London,
mm-hmm.
and the largest buildings in London by far are in the financial district.
Yeah.
So, you know, that kind of is a
reflection you go to
of
Chicago,
different values these days. So yes, I think that's absolutely true. One of the interpretations that's been made of Gothic buildings is that they do embody this sort of upward tendency, mm-hmm. that they were somehow meant to inspire people to think upwards, to think, to lift their minds to God, really. And this is something that even some of the clerics at the time wrote about. So I think that was, to some extent, that was explicitly, a part of this sort of tendency to build higher and higher. I do know entirely what you mean about the sense that one gets from the iconography of the buildings, that the fact that you're surrounded by these images of holy figures, both in the windows and in the sculpture. Some of the sculpture at Chartres, it should be said, is some of the finest in the Middle Ages. It's extraordinarily sensitive and beautiful, and has, to our good fortune, been very well preserved. I think that there are things to read into some of this imagery beyond the fact that they're merely representing these biblical figures. It's said that in the Gothic buildings you can really start to see the beginnings of a sense of putting, if you like, personality into religion, into these religious figures, that they're not just sort of stylized figures anymore. It's interesting to compare some of the sculpture in the Gothic building to the sculpture that's in the west entrance to the building, the main entrance called the Royal Portal, which dates from an earlier period, really from the Romanesque period of the 1130s, 1140s. Some of the figures from the Old Testament are portrayed in a very sort of stylized way, in a way that you could sort of see them as quite bland, whereas some of the sculptures in the transepts, the Gothic transepts from the later period, are a very human. There's something very sort of sympathetic about them, and this, I think, also reflects a changing attitude across that period of how people thought about religion and humankind's place in the universe. That it became much more, if you like, human centered, much more about putting human experience into the picture.
That's a very valid point, because if you follow the Romanesque, you go back all the way to the early churches, and you follow the technology, but you also follow the actual image itself as a church to hold. And you're right about Chartres; it's probably the pinnacle of Gothic. It's just an amazing piece of work. But thank you.
Everybody
should go. Bye.
Well, just to go back for a moment, you had the conversation with the first caller about this question of continuity and how over a long period of time, as some of the churches did take a long time to build, how it is they maintain continuity of design if there were different people working on the project. Now, you also said that, relatively speaking, this church was completed compared to a lot of others in a shorter period of time, and perhaps you could think of it as being within one lifetime. Having said all that, one of the first things I'm sure that people will notice when they see it or look at a picture of it is that the two spires of the church are in two different styles. How did that come to be?
Yes. Yes, people often ask about that. It has this sort of strange lopsided look to it at the west end. And that's simply because they were built at different times. The west end of the church is actually not a Gothic structure, as I sort of suggested before. It dates from earlier construction in the middle of the 12th century. Originally the spire on the north side of that was wooden, and it burnt down at a later period and was rebuilt at the end of the Gothic period. So it was rebuilt in a completely different style, and in fact in a completely different style from the rest of the building. It has this very sort of flamboyant style, covered in little sort of curlicues and elaboration and ornament that the rest of the building doesn't really have. So in some ways, it's quite incongruous. You know, I guess once one gets to sort of know the building, it seems to be part of its charm that it has this sort of strange lopsidedness. But it's certainly true that the northwest tower doesn't sort of fit in with the rest of the building. So that's really the reason that it was simply built at a different time.
One of the things that I'm really interested in having you talk about is the place that this building had in the life of the community at the time, and the fact that it was not just the centerpiece for religious life, it was a centerpiece for civic life and everyday life, that this was very much a part of people's lives being in and around the church, not just when services were held on Sunday, but perhaps all every day.
Well, yes. I mean, again, this is an aspect of how the church was seen and used in very different ways from the way we tend to look at them today. That it was the hub of the community spiritually, physically, and socially, because in some ways people might use the church as a meeting place. They even used it as a marketplace in some cases. There were it sort of seems extraordinary to think about this now, but there were sometimes stalls. Stallholders would set up in the aisles of the nave and sell their wares. Particularly wine merchants would do this. This was sort of quite a regular way in which medieval churches were used. And in fact, there are records at Chartres of when at one point the clerics decided that the winemakers had become too much of a nuisance. They were just sort of too disruptive because they would be yelling out their sort of advertising slogans to sell their wares in the aisles, and so they were banished down into the crypt. In many ways, the sort of day-to-day use of the church wasn't a place of sort of hushed reverence. There would often be a hubbub of townspeople coming and going and meeting each other. You know, sometimes they would sort of noblemen would bring their pets, their hawks and their dogs, to give them a bit of exercise. So it was, in some ways, it was a sort of a social center, a sort of social club for a town, as much as it was a spiritual center.
Yeah. There, one just other detail that I really like that attaches to this business of the wine merchants selling in the church, that apparently also one advantage to them was that they avoided taxes by doing that.
Well, this was one of the points of friction, really, between the clerics and the chapter, which were the clerics that basically sort of owned the church, the chapter and the bishop, between them and the local count, because within the quarters of the cathedral, so within the church itself and within the cloister around the cathedral. Anyone who was selling there was exempt from the taxes that otherwise a count would impose on merchants, and so the chapter had people making and selling wares on their behalf within the cloister, and they would get out of having to pay taxes this way, which was clearly something that the count wasn't awfully pleased about. So there was a lot of tension that arose from that, and it seems likely that those tensions were to some extent sort of fermented by the count and his retinue while the church was being built, and even led to rioting in the city as the townspeople were essentially sort of stirred up to resent the what seemed to be the special privileges that the clerics had. So far from being a picture of harmonious community that clubbed together to raise this building, this is the myth that's often told of the church building projects in the Middle Ages. At Chartres, at least, and most probably in other places too, there were a lot of tensions between the local authorities and between the townspeople and tradesmen and craftsmen and the clerics.
Mm. Well, that again is, I think, it gets another of these points that I think it's very interesting. People, I'm sure, have this idea that when a community decided to build a church, that everyone's heart would be filled with joy and that they would all pitch in and do the work to the greater glory of God, and that it was something that they did out of the goodness of their hearts. And the point that you make is, no, the people who built this didn't do it out of the goodness of their hearts. They expected to be paid. This was their work, and they were doing it for a living, and they expected to be paid. And in fact, there was conflict around those issues. And in fact, at one point in the year 1210, there was actually a riot that was perhaps inspired in part by the feelings of the people who were building the church and how they felt about the clerics who were there running the place.
Well, the riot in 1210 in Chartres was seemed to be more about the conflicts between the townsfolk and the clerics. So it was about something to do with the resentments that were created between those communities. But you're quite right that the builders themselves were basically people working for a wage, just as they are now. And just as they are now, they would sometimes grumble about that, and sometimes they would do, you know, their workmanship would be shoddy, and they'd cut corners, and people would the people who had commissioned them would have to keep an eye on them. So that's absolutely right. That picture has sometimes been distorted, sometimes calculatedly distorted, by the churchmen of the time. There are accounts from the early Gothic period of how local people would become sort of inspired with religious fervor and would all lend a hand to the church building process, and they would sometimes harness themselves to carts like beasts of burden and pull the carts along. It seems possible that sometimes something of this sort occasionally happened, but it also seems very likely that this was, again, there was a degree of propagandizing going on here, that really the churchmen were trying to sort of tell these stories to create some sense that actually this is how communities ought to behave, that they ought to show sort of proper reverence and devotion to a project of this sort. Whereas, in fact, you know, if there ever was a sort of holy fervor of this kind, it was most probably short-lived, and there may have even been a degree of coercion or stage management by the clerics to create it. Certainly, it seems implausible that an unskilled workforce of people just sort of laying down their normal day's work and going to join in the church building, it seems implausible that those sorts of people could have created structures of this sort. It took real skill and professionalism to put these buildings up, and they would have almost certainly been done in every sort of real measure. They would have been done by well-trained masons and craftsmen.
Yeah, I guess here I was thinking of what happened at 1210. I guess there, as you said, the issue there was between the clerics at the church and the townspeople who were unhappy about the taxes that they were paying, that were going to pay for building the church. They got so upset they went to the home of the man who was the head of the cathedral and trashed the place. And in response, he excommunicated the entire town.
That's right, yes. That's the kind of thing that one could do in those days if you were a bishop or a cleric. It kind of implies that, excommunication in some sense was taken very seriously in those days, because there was a real belief that it meant something about what would happen to you in the afterlife. But I think that there's probably also some sense in which it was used rather sort of too liberally by the clerics, and perhaps taken sometimes with a pinch of salt by the people it was applied to.
We have 7-8 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Philip Ball. We're talking about the Chartres Cathedral, the subject of his book Universe of Stone. We have another caller here, someone in Pontiac. We'll talk with them on our line 4. Hello.
Hello. Yeah. Hello. I love Chartres. I go to France every year, and that is one of my personal pilgrimages, is to take the train and spend the day in that town and visiting the cathedral. I wonder if you could tell the story about how during, maybe you have because I missed some of this, but during the revolution, how the townspeople were, starting to destroy the building, and I believe there was one person who got up and said, don't do this. You know, someday this will be an important place that people should preserve, and he managed to stop some of the destruction of the statues. Are you familiar with that story?
In what period did you hear of this happening?
Well, this was during the French Revolution.
Ah, okay. I was wondering, yes, if you were talking about the revolutionaries. Yes, well, I mean, the revolutionaries have a pretty poor reputation these days for what they did for France's heritage, because it's certainly true that many buildings were vandalized by the revolutionaries, and you know, Chartres was lucky to have been preserved. I've heard that I've heard something like that for Chartres. Certainly, you know, it seems clear that that it was left alone where many other buildings were destroyed. You know, one of the first targets for that sort of work, one of the easiest, was the windows. And we're so lucky that just about, you know, that so many of the original windows of Chartres have been preserved. So, yes, it was spared
special.
Some of the ravages that other buildings underwent during the revolution.
And have you talked at all about the labyrinth? I tried to go on a Friday where they clear the chairs off and you can actually walk the labyrinth, which is really quite a wonderful experience.
Yeah, the labyrinth is... Labyrinth is something of a mystery. Very often, if you go and if you take some of the tours that are available in Chartres, you may well be told that the labyrinth was part of the, if you like, part of the pilgrimage experience, that pilgrims would go there and walk the labyrinth on their knees, and that somehow it represents one's spiritual path through life. To be honest, there's no clear evidence from the time that was really how these the labyrinths were seen. The labyrinth at Chartres, by the way, is one of the very few that's still remaining from that period. At Amiens Cathedral, the labyrinth has been restored. The original one was ripped up, and at many of the other cathedrals that had them, they no longer do. So it was a common motif that was used in the buildings at that time, but we don't really know what it was for. It does seem very likely that, at least in some sense, labyrinths were more an emblem of the Masons than of anything spiritual. There's a strong tradition in medieval masonry that linked their skills back to the building of the labyrinth on Crete, the labyrinth of the Minotaur, that was built by Daedalus. So this seems to be that somehow it was an emblem of their craft. And certainly in some of the labyrinths, there are inscriptions or plaques within them that depict the master builders responsible for the project. So, you know, that's another reason to believe that they were actually linked with the guilds of the Masons.
Uh-huh. Well, I'm going in March again. I go every year, and because I'm usually on a shoestring, one of my most fun things to do is to travel to one of the towns and visit the cathedrals, but I think Chartres is my favorite.
Well, thank you for advertising it. I really try to encourage anyone who hasn't been there to go, because it is extraordinary. And the town itself is very lovely as well. It's, you know, really worth a visit. Very easy to get to from Paris.
We're down to the point, I want to thank the caller, we're down to the point where we have up maybe about 2 minutes. And there is so much that we really haven't touched on. I guess what I would like to ask you to do, and unfortunately we don't have a lot of time, is perhaps talk a little bit about why, you know, the question, we've talked about the fact that this represents a different style of architecture from what had gone before, from the Romanesque to what came to be called the Gothic. Then this invites this question, why did this change occur for those people who were building Gothic cathedrals like this? What were they thinking? Why did they decide that they wanted to build in a new way?
Right. Well, that's really the big question, and to be honest, that's what that's really what my book is about. I think first of all, we have to say that clearly something did change in the way people thought in order to bring about this change in church building, because this was such an important part of medieval culture that it wouldn't be done on the whim of some architect who just thought, you know, I'm going to do something different. That it must have been some kind of reflection of a change in the way people saw their relationship both to God and to the universe. And it seems very plausible that it was linked with what's often called the 12th century Renaissance, a real resurgence of learning, particularly of learning about science and natural philosophy, that happened in Europe at that time. For various reasons, but one of the biggest was that Europeans started to gain access to the works of the classical authors, the Greek and Roman authors who were writing on these subjects, because of the interactions between the West and the Islamic world. And in the Islamic world, these classical works had been preserved in Arabic translation. Science was very much respected within that tradition. So there were people from Europe who were discovering these works through Arabic translation, were learning Arabic and then translating the books into Latin so that they were available throughout Christendom. And this seems to have led to a real sort of resurgence in learning and a real shift in perspective about the way people thought of their position in the universe. They started to see it as a place that was governed by logic and reason. And one can make the case that the Gothic cathedrals are a reflection of this, that they essentially convey a universe that is ordered, that is rational.
Well, I am sorry to say that we're going to have to stop because we're here at the end of our time. My apologies, we have a caller that we cannot take, but if you're certainly interested in reading more on the subject, you can seek out the book that we have mentioned a couple of times. The title is Universe of Stone, A Biography of Chartres Cathedral, by our guest Philip Ball. He is consulting editor for Nature magazine, regular commentator on science in Great Britain. Mr. Ball, thank you very much for talking with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.